Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, Virginia, Washington, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Wyoming.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. We are exactly 1 week away from the Iowa caucuses, and the Democratic primary race is in flux. Senator Bernie Sanders has gained support in national and early state polls, and his odds of winning the nomination, according to our model, have noticeably increased. At the same time, Senator Elizabeth Warren's odds have taken a tumble. So today, we're going to discuss where the race stands in the final run-up to Iowa. We're also going to check in on the political calculus facing Republican senators after new reporting on a draft of former National Security Advisor John Bolton's book. Bolton reportedly claims that President Trump explicitly tied freezing military aid to Ukraine to investigations of Democrats, including the Bidens. And here with me to discuss all of that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going?
You know, I was bothered by something you said in the intro.
Oh, God.
Here we go.
You said we're exactly 1 week away from the Iowa caucuses. The Iowa caucuses are at night, and we're recording this in the late morning, so it's more like a week point five away, 7.5 days away.
That is the most Nate thing you've ever said.
No, I think it's important to keep in mind that caucuses are an actual thing that people get together. You can't pick and choose when you go to the caucus.
But to be clear, you're disputing that he's not using the hour.
It's literally not important.
I'm actually speechless. Okay. Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone.
Hi.
Hey, I'm just saying. Thank you. That's how you do it, Nate. That's how you do it.
If you're an Iowa caucus goer and you go to your caucus site exactly 1 week from when we're recording this,
that's what you're worried
empty.
About. You're worried
pretty empty.
Someone's listening in Iowa and they're like, oh, 1 week away. Okay.
Also, when people are listening to this, which is going to be drive time tonight when we publish it, it will be exactly 1 week from now.
Oh, shit.
Wow. Galen won that one. Mic drop, Galen. Walk out.
Mic drop. Okay. Also here with us is Managing Editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Pleasure to be here.
And despite all that, Nate, we have some happy news. It is our fourth birthday. We launched this podcast exactly 1 week before the Iowa caucuses in 2016. Listeners can probably tell we've spent 4 years together.
You announced that in the channel on Friday. And my initial thought was like, Nate has been my podcast sparring partner. For a long time.
Would you say the relationship's improved or worsened over the 4 years?
What would you say?
Improved. I think it's gone through phases.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... I feel like listeners get a weird impression, but like we really like each other, I think.
We do. We actually sort of hang out and enjoy it sometimes.
Yeah.
I think surprise!
That was super convincing. Here are, according to the CDC, here are the milestones a four-year-old should reach.
Okay.
Cooperates with other children.
Nope.
No, we haven't reached that. Often can't tell what's real and what's make-believe. I think that's still true for us. Knows some basic rules of grammar, such as correctly using he and she.
We do that.
Tell stories. We do that. I think we're a little behind for a four-year-old, but we're getting there.
I listened to like 10 minutes of the first episode we ever recorded.
Yeah, how was it?
It's fine.
I think we have improved.
It's improved, yeah.
Yeah, I think like recent additions to the podcast have really sort of solidified it. Take it from
I will say
B minus C plus to A.
It used to take me a lot longer to edit the podcast.
Oh, interesting.
You just have Stockholm syndrome.
People have gotten better at speaking, I think, just in general. You know, not using filler words or being concise and to the point in expressing their points. Sometimes. Well, that was fun. Happy birthday, everybody. Anyway, according to the 5:30 Democratic primary forecast, Sanders' odds of winning the majority of delegates increased from 22% on Friday, just 3 days ago, to 28% today on Monday. Nate, what's behind Sanders' surge beyond the top level odds? Is it clear that it's more based on early state level polls or national polls?
It's both, which is kind of what you'd expect. This is kind of a medium speed, medium sized surge, right? It's not kind of sudden like the Kamala Harris surge after the debate. It hasn't been as prolonged as the now reversed, frankly, Elizabeth Warren surge of the summer and fall, but it's well-timed. What is behind it? I suspect part of it is that, believe it or not, there are actually some degree of lanes in the primary, and I think that probably some people who are on the fence between Sanders and Warren are coming back to Sanders. I also suspect that there are undecided voters, and there are votes for minor candidates, right, who might drop out of the race or might be at 1% or 2%, right? And some of those probably go to Sanders. It does not really seem to be coming at Biden's expense. I mean, if you look at our polling average, you know that Biden is like, oh, he's at exactly 27%, and he's at exactly 27 or 27.1 or something as we're recording this late morning. You know, if you want to get more complicated, there are probably some conflicting dynamics going on, right, where Buttigieg has fallen a bit. Maybe his supporters go to Warren, but then some Warren supporters go to Bernie, right? Maybe Biden would actually be gaining and not holding steady if not for this actual Bloomberg gains in the poll. So there are always different dynamics. Let me say one other thing. There's like this kind of meme going around or narrative going around that, hey, Bernie has always been in this position and he's been ignored. That's not true. This actual 5 or 6 point surge he had that he's had is pretty important because being at 15% nationally, which is where Warren is, at least according to our model, is a much worse position. Not that it's hopeless for her, but like much worse than being at 21% where Bernie is.
Is it accurate to say the Sanders surge, such as it is, it's kind of felt like it's happened in two stages where there was, I don't know, it was like a month and a half ago where we were writing on the site and talking about on this podcast, hey, Bernie Sanders is actually in a pretty decent position here and is the second most likely to win the nomination. And then more recently, you've had kind of another little surge where he's
yeah, I think there was kind of like a few weeks ago or a month ago, like this change in perception.
Exactly.
That was people kind of finally noticed that, oh, okay, well, Warren has slipped into third place. That happened in our polling average around Thanksgiving, that Sanders overtook Warren for second place, but more with Warren falling than him gaining, right? And then people are like, okay, well, there were all these kind of magic scenarios where Deval Patrick will get in or Bloomberg will get in, which he did, I guess, right? Or something will happen. Klobuchar will surge or something. And none of that really happens. People are like, kind of like, okay, well, if Biden doesn't win it, and Biden's a whole other case of someone who's also oddly kind of ignored for being in a good position in the polls, then maybe Bernie will actually either win or be the main rival. But then he has actually gained.
Recently.
And those are important gains. Just like you can't win very many states with 15% of the vote. You can't win states with 22% of the vote. You know, the one slightly sour note for Sanders is that I'd say his surge is the most ambiguous in Iowa.
And let's talk a little bit more about the specific state of the race in Iowa in a minute. But first, we can look at all of these polls and see that Sanders is doing better. Obviously, the polls are not themselves going to tell us why exactly that's happening. What are some theories? I mean, Claire, do you have an idea of what's going on here for voters, if it's the conflict between him and Warren or something else?
I think what's interesting to watch with Sanders in Iowa is the actual pitch he's giving to voters, which is a general election pitch. Right. He is saying basically like the same thing on the stump that his controversial talking points to door knockers that started the whole Warren feud said, which is Bernie Sanders brings Trump voter types back to the Democratic Party more than any other candidate will. And I think it's an interesting pitch. Now, you'll see tons of Obama people, campaign types from the Obama era floating around and saying, we got to cut this off at the legs. Sanders cannot win the primary. He is not a good general election candidate. You're seeing, obviously, newspaper endorsements go to more moderate candidates. But I think that the argument that Elizabeth Warren is perhaps troubled from the, and we use it with all the fraughtness that it entails, Elizabeth Warren has been stuck with the electability thing, in part because she is a woman, I think, and in part because she's maybe been trying to ride the line a little bit more about how liberal her positions are and how doable they are. People just kind of like the idea that Sanders has been this one thing the entire time. And I think there's some gut instinct from people where they say, I don't know, maybe he has a point about the general election thing, right? And I think it has a little bit to do with Warren falling and Sanders kind of having a good past month or so. I mean, I think he was pretty good on the last debate.
Are voters in the debate actually liked Warren's performance, but that didn't seem to translate into, I mean, she's not had a particularly good run of general election polls.
If you look at national polls, like just to keep this super simple, Sanders' increase has coincided with a slight Warren downtick and a gradual Buttigieg downslope. And just kind of at a glance, that makes some amount of sense to me that he would pick up that his that
Buttigieg voters.
Well, why would people vote for Buttigieg?
I mean, if you look at the overlaps, people say, who are you considering? Buttigieg Sanders is one of the least overlapping.
But you're talking about a gain of a few percentage points here. So, like, you get what I mean? It's not like it takes all that many voters to increase it, but like,
yeah.
Why would someone vote for Buttigieg, right? He's this 37-year-old mayor of a small town. I think one of the big reasons people were considering him and are considering him is they think he's electable. They think here's a fresh face, will look good on a debate stage against Trump. And so I wonder if some of those people are now looking at Sanders as, oh, actually, maybe counterintuitive, put the ideology aside for a second. Sanders is actually the electable candidate. He can put some of these places in the Midwest.
Like excites young people, basically.
Excites young people, can win over some of those Obama-Trump voters, et cetera, et cetera.
One thing that you mentioned, Nate, that I wanted to come back to is this idea that some of the minor candidates could be losing support that ultimately goes to Sanders. I've heard people talk about that earlier in the race, like Tulsi Gabbard or Andrew Yang, if their support would eventually go to Sanders. Is there any actual evidence of that in the polls at this point?
So Yang is actually
gained. Yang surging.
Yang surge has actually gained. He's actually ahead of the much more heralded Amy Klobuchar in our national polling average and is at like 4%. So Yang.
So no, the answer is no, basically.
But, you know, but look, there are a lot of other candidates, right? There were formerly Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and Julian Castro, right? And they didn't do that well, but they collectively had, you know, 7 or 8% of the vote. You have an undecided vote that I think was around 12 or 13%, right? I mean, Mike said something earlier, which is like important to emphasize, right? We're not talking about an earth-shatteringly large change in absolute terms, right? Sanders has gone from 15 or 16% international polling average as of kind of the mid to late summer to 18% as of December to 21% now, right? That's not like a earth-shatteringly large change in absolute terms. It just happens to be pretty important just because the way the math works, when you go from 15 to 21, as I said, like, though that's an important kind of inflection point. And so it's not like we're talking about him having made enormous pickups. They're just important. And, you know, and there are these kind of votes floating around that give you opportunities to gain ground.
And so maybe that's why the surge looks more dramatic if you're looking at the forecast than if you're just looking at national polling.
Well,
it's not even that dramatic in the forecast. I mean, it's meaningful, but it's like, his chances have gone up, what, 4 or 5 percentage points?
I mean, by the way, one of the thing about
3 days.
One of the thing about the forecast is that we're nearing actual voting, right? So if this were
a week,
if this were the summer,
not exactly a week.
If this were a weak point, if this were the summer, then there'd be reason to say, okay, well, that's nice, but like, there are probably going to be more shifts in the race, right? So it's the timing of it that matters, right? Because, yeah, I mean, you could kind of say, okay, nothing's really changed, blah, 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 right? Some polls have him down, some polls have him up. But, like, gaining a few points at this time is pretty nicely timed for Bernie. I don't mean to make that imply as though, like, he's just been lucky. I mean, maybe it is, you know, the fact that he has a lot of money. He has very enthusiastic supporters. I mean, I still think the pivotal moment in this whole campaign is the moment when Warren surges. She's kind of declared a national front runner or co-front runner in mid-October. And then neither the left nor the kind of moderates really embrace her, right? Because you can imagine either one of those things having happened. You can imagine the left having said, we have things we like about Bernie, we have things we like about Warren, but Warren is almost in a position where she can beat Biden, and gosh, now if we throw a support to her, she's going to be nominated, right? Didn't happen. In fact, Sanders got like some key endorsements from AOC and the squad. The Sanders supporters, who were some of the most vocal people, became pretty anti-Warren, right? So that happened. At the same time, the establishment got terrified of nominating Warren. Mayor Pete kind of hit her from the right. And it kind of worked, right? And so she really got squeezed.
And Sanders hasn't actually gotten that much. Attacks don't necessarily stick to him. In part, like, you see him getting a little bit more criticism, particularly in interviews with journalists where people say he continually fails to give specifics for his policy proposals. But I do think voters are also kind of like, I don't know, it doesn't really matter if you don't have specifics. You're probably not going to get anything passed, but we'd like to have a forceful advocate from this side of things. I don't know. I think there's something interesting going on with that. And also, there's a little bit to go to the grassroots support stuff. And if we're trying to really think through tangibly what's going on in these last couple of weeks in Iowa on the ground and the caucus things, obviously the caucuses are a really communal, persuasion-based way of voting. And the Sanders campaign has had this kind of viral persuasion campaign where people will say, talk to your friends and family about why you're voting for Bernie Sanders, right? Which is kind of a way, I think, for the campaign to recognize the problem it's had online with certain supporters giving the campaign a sort of noxious name.
And some of their staffers, right?
Correct. Read Mark Tracy's profile of David Serrata, a sometimes sparring partner of Nate Silver on the Twitter.
I was going to say.
But I think that that's an interesting thing. Like, how was that playing out in Iowa in the last week before the caucuses? You know, that those sort of like, you know, homespun persuasion, like talk to grandma about, hey, you were in a union. Bernie Sanders is the union candidate.
I think there was some type of shift that kind of coincided with the heart attack that Sanders had and the kind of Bernie is back, which focused on a more positive message, right? Because one interpretation is that Sanders was actually underperforming before, that having gotten 43% of the vote before and being at only 15% nationally was pretty weak, and that he is now fulfilling his potential as they have shifted toward a more positive message, including from the campaign itself, of telling its online supporters, like, literally, hey, be chill, be nice, right? As opposed to kind of the first half of the year where it was very online, very confrontational. And I think you have, you know, they still have that gear, obviously. But I do think that, like, the tone has shifted in a way that has helped Sanders.
I want to talk a little bit more specifically about Iowa. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by C-SPAN. Go deep, direct, and unfiltered with C-SPAN's Campaign 2020. You'll find in-depth coverage of all the candidates, issues, and events that are steering us to Election Day. Follow the campaigns on C-SPAN and then dig even deeper in C-SPAN's online archive. Get an unfiltered view of politics with C-SPAN's Campaign 2020 on the C-SPAN television networks, on the C-SPAN app, or online at cspan.org. Make up your own mind with C-SPAN's Campaign 2020. Today's podcast is also brought to you by ADT Commercial for Business. It's not politics as usual these days, and it's not business as usual at ADT. ADT Commercial serves businesses ranging from mid-sized organizations to large-scale enterprises. Think of them as national security advisors just for your company. They provide comprehensive security, fire, life safety, and risk management solutions, professional-grade systems for commercial-grade businesses. The Fortune 1000 trust ADT Commercial for highly complex, scalable, integrated solutions. And if you're looking for a great partner to upgrade or take over the monitoring and service of your current system, ADT Commercial can help to install and maintain large-scale and multi-site business dependably. Businesses choose ADT Commercial for their complex security solutions. Visit ADT.com/538 to learn more. Again, that's ADT.com/538. All right, we're back. And we've talked about what the picture looks like more nationally, and we're starting to get to what things look like on the ground in Iowa. The conventional wisdom about how you win Iowa is that you surge late in the game and beat expectations. Is what Sanders is doing surging late in the game, or is there still kind of room for things to get mixed up quite a bit when it actually comes down to caucus day?
As far as Iowa goes, I mean, it's a good question, Galen. I think the answer is the timing might be perfect for Bernie, or it might not be perfect, and we won't really know until a week from today, a week and change from today. Yeah, look, so there literally is the, you know, the kind of scenario of a candidate surging extremely late, that has happened before. Like John Kerry's surge in 2004 happened extremely late. Rick Santorum's surge in 2012 happened extremely late. So I don't know what the mechanism might be, but you do have to, I mean, look, our model still has these gigantic confidence intervals for Iowa, right? It says, well, Bernie will get somewhere between 8% and 42% of the vote, probably, right? And that is born out of the fact that, number one, polling in a caucus is always a little bit rough. Number two, you absolutely can have a media narrative that shifts over 7 days. I do think it's amazing, by the way, that the two national frontrunners, there's not really active, like, negative storylines about either Biden or Sanders right now. I do kind of wonder if the Sanders prickliness, not from Sanders himself, but from people around him, makes people afraid to attack him. And that does Bernie good. I don't know, right?
So, I mean, when it comes to media narrative in the run-up to the caucuses, one thing that happened over the weekend is the Des Moines Register endorsed Elizabeth Warren. We've talked a little bit about whether or not endorsements matter in the past, but Clara Micah, do you see this particular endorsement being meaningful given how important Iowa is?
Generally, on this podcast, we talk about endorsements from, like, party elites, elected officials. Here we're talking about a newspaper endorsement, right, which is similar, I guess, but a little different. Jeffrey Skelly, one of our elections analysts, looked at this for the site. The Des Moines Register's endorsement has at least coincided with, on average, about a 4 or 5 point bump in when you compare people's polls at the time of the endorsement to how they eventually finished. Now, some years, like John Edwards in 2004, was polling at about 11% when he got the endorsement and won about 33% of the vote. So that's a huge bump. Was it down to the Des Moines Register endorsement? Well, I don't know. Other years, there was basically no change, right? But I think the right way to look at it is what Nate was just getting at, which is primaries are so fluid and primary polling is so inexact that you just have to go into it thinking, hey, anything could still happen here. And our forecast reflects that, right? So, like, in this last week, it is totally possible, let's say people in Iowa conclude that Buttigieg doesn't have a chance. His support evaporates. Where does that go? Let's say Klobuchar, who has actually been gaining ground in Iowa polls, she's like in the high single digits now. People might conclude, oh, actually, that she didn't get high enough, that I'm not going to waste my vote on Klobuchar. I think a lot of her support could go to Warren, right, or to Biden, or to anybody else. So I think this race is still very much, it's still like any, including Klobuchar, any of these people could win, and it wouldn't be that surprising, right?
The Klobuchar win would be surprising because she has to leapfrog four other people. It would not be surprising if she got like third place.
In which case, given that she has like a New Hampshire newspaper endorsement, how would that serve? That's an interesting thing, right? If Amy Klobuchar does decently well in Iowa, probably isn't going to win, but like, I don't know, win, place, show. She places her shows. What does that do, Nate, for her chances in New Hampshire vis-a-vis the model? Maybe this is a good teachable moment.
Klobuchar actually does sort of pull okay in New Hampshire specifically, but I am skeptical of like there are definitely scenarios where Klobuchar, let's say, finishes top three in Iowa. The media, which has, after ignoring her for much of the year, kind of frankly seems eager for a Klobuchar surge, right? I could see her becoming like kind of a factor, sort of in the way that like John Huntsman was briefly a factor, right? After finishing third in New Hampshire, and then, you know, maybe she also finishes third in New Hampshire, and then, you know, frankly, I don't think either Nevada or South Carolina look like very good states for her, and then she maybe wins the Minnesota primary, no longer a caucus, on Super Tuesday, and then bows out or something, right? So for every one scenario she actually wins or comes close, there are 10 scenarios involving her becoming a factor, but not actually coming that close to winning, right? And that's the barrier, right? Like, if she were consistently, there's a poll that came out last night that had her at 12 or 13% in third place, right? That's poll, however, is an exception. If you consistently had polls like that, if she really at 13% instead of 8, like, that actually matters a fair bit at 13%.
In Iowa.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with any of that. The one thing I will say is you could imagine Klobuchar surging in Iowa and it being super isolated, just given her regional connections to the state. I do think it's noteworthy that she has also climbed, not a ton, but she hasn't climbed a ton in Iowa either. You know, she's up to the mid to high single digits in New Hampshire too. So maybe that does suggest that if she is able to do something in Iowa, she at least has some base to work off of in New Hampshire.
We kind of pivoted away from talking about the Des Moines Register's endorsement of Warren, but I'm curious, Claire, you talked about Sanders' closing argument in Iowa basically being Bernie beats Trump, which is what you see on the signs, right? What is Warren's closing argument?
Warren's closing argument seems to be one that's more of a traditional Democratic primary appeal, which is, I am the one who best represents your desires for the future, and I am the smartest and best equipped to do the job. I think in other years, that would be a persuasive argument to Democratic primary voters. But in a primary where people are obsessed with Trump, Trump is like this fascinating boogeyman to Democratic primary voters, for good reasons, certainly. But there's this idea of how will he get under the person's skin, right? As if we haven't seen 4 years of evidence for how he does it, which is like, you know,
he'll figure out, like, no matter who you are, he'll figure out
a way. He'll figure it out. He'll do something. And I think there's also, I mean, this is the sort of more interesting part to me in some ways, which is voters seem to care less about ability to do the job, probably because of Trump, right? The idea of there used to be this idea that only geniuses, megalomaniacal or otherwise, ran for president and were good at the job. Perhaps the public has been disabused of that notion. There's more of a recognition that the presidency is and can be bolstered by smart and powerful and influential non-actors. And therefore, you want a person who is ideologically pure from your point of view to occupy the office. Anyway, Elizabeth Warren, I think, perhaps, as we're seeing through the numbers, suffers from having quite a coherent and traditional appeal to primary voters.
She's also making the electability case in the last days. The Des Moines Register has this headline, Elizabeth Warren's closing argument to Iowans, women win, quote unquote. I think that's telling in two ways. One, it shows to some extent that she's been on the defensive on that point as people have raised these electability questions. But two, at least unless there's a swing in the last few days, you know, it does suggest that, to Claire's point, the boogeyman of Trump, I think you saw in 2018, Democratic voters after the Clinton loss in 2016 were like, we are going to rally behind women, try to elect women to offices. That's important to us. I think you've seen beating Trump take the place of that to some extent in 2020, where a lot of voters are saying electing women is important to us. Beating Trump is the first priority. And that's how we have essentially three men, you know, atop the polling charts.
I'm curious, this is something that the model can tell us, although it's not public information. We can see what would happen if each one of those four candidates were to win the Iowa caucuses. In a nutshell, I don't want to take up too much time with this, but how does each of them winning the Iowa caucuses shift the national picture?
Biden winning puts him in a fairly commanding position where he's already ahead nationally. There'd be a lot of skepticism about why did this Bernie thing fizzle out or whatever. Bernie winning, I think, leads to a very competitive race between probably Bernie and Biden, in which, depending on Bernie's margin of victory and where Biden finishes, either candidate could be kind of the slight favorite. Warren winning would at this point likely create a big bounce because it would be a comeback story. Her polling is not as robust as Sanders's or Biden's in states after Iowa. So that could be a case where you get a bounce, it becomes very competitive, but that really might be more 50-50-ish, right? Also, Sanders might not want to, I don't think he'd quit unless he did really badly, right? And Buttigieg winning is kind of your kind of, or Klobuchar can kind of be the same case, right? That's your kind of classic, they would get a bounce and become a big part of the conversation. I tend to think, based on looking at scenarios in the model, they would not necessarily become the favorite. They might become the second favorite behind, depending on who did well there, maybe Biden or something. But it's not that hard to figure out. I mean, the silver lining in Iowa for Warren, you'd much rather be gaining in the polls in Iowa. You'd much rather be in Bernie's position than Warren's position. There is a slight silver lining, which is that because expectations factor into the bounce, that now Bernie's win in Iowa is a little bit more expected. That might lead to a smaller bounce. Warren's win would be considered very surprising, even though she's not that far behind. I think a Buttigieg win would be considered surprising now, even though he is also not that far behind. In fact, he's really just a couple of points off the front runners. So in some ways, like, the question is, okay, is Sanders is like surge well-timed? I mean, the answer is probably yes. But the downside to that is that the conventional wisdom, even though polls show basically Sanders and Biden tied in Iowa, the conventional wisdom is that Iowa is Bernie's to lose. You know, if I were Bernie, I would love to, like, downplay expectations a little bit, because that conclusion's not really justified based on the polls, where he's tied for the lead and you have third and fourth and maybe a fifth place candidate who still have some chances also.
So let's wrap on this. Given how much attention has been focused on Sanders now that he's improved his position in, you know, national and state level polling, is the Democratic cavalry, establishment cavalry, coming out against him, or are they still choosing to remain somewhat on the sidelines in this primary?
Well, great question. There have been rumblings for quite a while that Barack Obama does not like Bernie Sanders and does not want him to win the Democratic primary. Hillary Clinton obviously stirred up a lot of noise last week when she basically said no one likes him and doesn't want to work with him, which is obviously lots of voters do actually like him. I think she was more referring to, I think we can interpret that she was referring to the establishment. But, you know, there's a Politico piece that quoted, for instance, Obama's 2012 campaign spokesman, Ben LaBolt, basically saying he's got to be stopped. Now, Obama world people did forcefully push back on a piece last week that sort of said Obama himself has said that he doesn't want Sanders to be around. I think the Obama people are really protective of Obama's sort of role as he's the one president in this Trump-Obama tussle who's actually maintaining his dignity, cares about the Constitution, about the, you know, sort of the higher statesman-like duties, and he's not going to put a thumb on the scale for anyone, no matter how he feels personally. I don't know if that's true, but that's certainly the public line they're taking and taking very forcefully. So I think that's probably coming from some, you know, informal networks of that former White House. But it's interesting. Obviously, when the name the Obama Coalition is, you know, it's your name, you probably, and the Obama Coalition being working class whites and young people and black voters turning out in, you know, all in concert to elect a Democrat, you might have some, shall we say, bias towards that particular strategy, whereas Bernie Sanders would say, it's old. It's an old paradigm. You can't think that way anymore. So I don't know.
I don't think the Democratic establishment has done anything meaningful to combat Bernie. I think you've seen some stories about, you know, it's kind of like the Republican serious concerns. And
it's,
and
like, is it in the nature of the Democratic Party to do that?
Well,
like,
maybe not. In addition to that, Democrats have the same problem that Republicans did in 2016, which is the most effective way, if you're really worried that Bernie Sanders can't win a general election and you want to prevent him from winning the nomination, the most effective way would be to rally behind another candidate. We've seen Biden climb in our endorsement tracker a bit, but it's not like most Democrats are still sitting on the sidelines.
He's gotten quite a few endorsements, although they're mostly from like mayors and representatives, right? And not like Sanders and governors.
Right. So I just don't think you've seen any movement on the part of established Democrats to stop Bernie that is at all likely to have any effect yet. Now, if he wins Iowa, wins New Hampshire, I think you might see a lot of Democrats say, okay, the time is now. We're rallying behind Biden, blah, 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 depending on the results. Or maybe not. Like, we kept waiting for that to happen in 2016 for Republicans and never did.
Let me raise three very important differences, which is why I think the Sanders-Trump parallels are overstated, at least in this respect, right? Number one is that Sanders is much closer to the Democratic mainstream than Trump was to what we understood the Republican mainstream to be in 2016, right? He has been on the left of the party, but his agenda isn't that different than other candidates who have moved to the left. I mean, compared to Trump, right? He's not explicitly criticizing past GOP nominees, right? It's a matter of degrees, but like, right.
Yeah.
Okay, number two.
You could have a debate about that. Could have a substantive debate about that.
You could, and Nate, the words you put in there that we understood at the time are important there. I think Trump is pretty close to the Republican mainstream.
But not the way that the establishment perceived it.
Well, here's an example. Trump literally flipped some Republican positions on like Social Security and Medicare, for example. Is Sanders literally flipping a core Democratic policy? Or like free trade? He flipped the Republicans' position on free trade.
I guess my argument would be, forget like policy positions for a second. Most political actors are like super crass and don't actually give a shit about any of this stuff.
Oh.
And so.
Sure, fine.
And so it's more about how would this person being the nominee affect me, right? And I think what we learned about Republicans was they decided I could get by just fine. I wonder if Democrats will conclude the same thing with Bernie. You see a lot of reporting about, oh, red state senators are concerned about Bernie Sanders as a nominee. We saw the same reporting with Trump in 2016, but like ultimately, you know.
That's where a lot of the endorsements are coming from for Biden is actually from, or in some cases for other candidates, even like Bloomberg, is coming from these swing district representatives. But let me give you two other differences, right? Number two is that Sanders is not in as strong a position as Trump was.
Yeah.
Sanders is not leading in national polls by 10 points. He's trailing in national polls by 6 points.
That's a big one, yeah.
That's big, right? Number three is that Democratic delegate allocation rules give the party and voters more ability to change their mind late in the race because you do not have these winner-take-all states. And so Bernie actually has to win a majority or else superdelegates come into play and you have kind of a scenario that, of course, all the journalists would find really fun, but a contested convention. And so that gives the party like a bit more time than you have with Trump where you all of a sudden have these winner-take-all states. So those are differences. I mean, there's also like, I don't know, right? I think a difference number four is that I think alluded to this earlier. I think the party doesn't necessarily think there's a slam dunk electability argument
against him.
I think if you talk to the average Democratic Party actor, I'm just going to guess, okay, and this matches the candidate's position in polls, I think it would say if we have to pick between the top four, we would prefer on electability grounds Biden. But after that,
exactly.
Bernie. I think that's honestly what the average, if you corner the average establishment person, I think that's what the average person would think.
But to be clear, there isn't a slam dunk electability case against Sanders, nor Warren.
No, and he does the second best in the polls against Trump, which we wouldn't wait much, but like that's worth noting.
Well, we actually have one more topic to discuss today. We've already
impeachment.
Had an almost entire podcast about the current state of the Democratic primary race and Iowa and Sanders, et cetera. But let's talk about these new revelations being reported from the draft of John Bolton's book. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart, and growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That's ZipRecruiter.com. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, experienced how challenging hiring can be after unsuccessfully searching for a director of coffee for his organic coffee company. But then he switched to ZipRecruiter and saw an immediate difference. And you can too by signing up for free at ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. And its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. So you get qualified candidates faster. In fact, after posting his job to ZipRecruiter, Dylan said he was amazed by how quickly great candidates were applying, and he found his new director of coffee in just a few days. Try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. On Sunday, the New York Times reported on a manuscript of former National Security Advisor John Bolton's book. The Times wrote that, quote, President Trump told his National Security Advisor in August that he wanted to continue freezing $391 million in security assistance to Ukraine until officials there helped with investigations into the Democrats, including the Bidens. Claire, how is this reporting from Bolton's book different from what we already knew?
Well, it's spelling out what a lot of other people have basically said was their impression of why Trump wanted to withhold aid from Ukraine, namely to hold it over the head of the Ukrainians so that they would get quote unquote dirt on Biden. Bolton is kind of saying it from the inside. He's saying it, you know, not as a not as a Democrat, right, but as an in the tank, hawkish Trump White House Republican. This is what happened. I was a national security advisor. I was privy to a lot of stuff. This is true. This was what Trump wanted. And here's the goddamn book, right? I mean, it's, you know.
Yeah. And it's worth saying that Trump tweeted out shortly after this New York Times report came out that Bolton was not telling the truth and that this never happened.
Yeah. And, you know, people, I guess people do a lot of things to sell their books, which is what Trump's figuring his line of argumentation is. But it seems, given the fact that this is basically bolstering what numerous other people have said, and probably like what common sense says in many ways, given the accumulated number of people telling the same story about what Trump was saying, like it's not a surprising, it's not coming out of the blue what Bolton is saying.
Given what other people have said and Trump's record of lying, I think you would easily conclude that Bolton is telling the truth if these reports about what his book says are true. But to Claire's point, the fact that this is just coming out now when his book goes on pre-order is f-ing ridiculous. Like, let's be clear about that. How freaking crass can you get? You have the impeachment of the president of the United States. You have relevant information about it. And I don't know that these leaks came from the Bolton camp, but it certainly looks that way. And you're like, you're using this relevant information to sell your book? Like, are you freaking kidding me?
The Bolton
people. I've worked with book publishers. I could see.
The Bolton people, we should say, are saying, oh, this is coming from the White House. Just getting that out there.
Come on. Like, okay, to make a serious point off of this, like, I think it goes to show you how there have been moments during this impeachment trial where the media sort of like pretends that this is an actual debate about substance and people are actually kind of weighing the legal arguments for and against impeachment and the constitutional questions and the evidence for and against what the allegations are against Trump. This kind of thing just, I think, should serve as a reminder of like how much of a game this is to the people involved, right? Where one of the principal players in this drama feels fine withholding relevant information, maybe until his book is available for sale. Like, it should just be a reminder that there are a lot of people taking all of this seriously, and they should. A lot of the principal actors involved are not. Does that make sense?
I mean, I don't know if it's fair to extrapolate from John Bolton that people aren't debating in an intellectual way the legal requirements of the Constitution. Like, the argument over what actually happened, it's pretty clear what actually
we know
happened.
What happened.
We've had that information. But then saying, and therefore, according to our Constitution, this president needs to be removed, I believe that there are people who are grappling with that intellectual question.
Principal actors? Like senators?
Yeah.
How many?
I don't know.
I think the majority of senators are not approaching this question.
Can I hijack this and talk about the institutions of government?
Sure. This is about
that is yeah this yeah. is like, about the institutions of government.
Yeah, but I'm hijacking in a different direction. It's so interesting to read articles about like the ratings are terrible for this, and it's like really understandable because it's super boring. I've watched it. But what's crazy is it's just like a total neutering of the legislative branch by the legislative branch.
Self-neutering.
But I mean, it's astounding.
It's amazing.
It is absolutely astounding. Like, that's my whole reaction to this, is just like, they're just like gutting an institution.
Given that, does it seem like this new information will, because actually, Mikey, you're saying that this is coming out at the perfect time for Bolton. This is also coming out at the perfect time for Democrats if they were going to put Republican senators in an awkward position about voting against having witnesses, right? So does this new information change the calculus at all for at least four Republican senators on the question of whether or not they're going to have Bolton testify?
Oh, it might. So since this story came out, Mitt Romney saying he thinks it's likely that more Republicans will say we need to see witnesses, although even Romney said, I haven't made my final decision yet, blah, 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 blah. Lindsey Graham tweeted something like, if we hear from witnesses, we have to hear from the Bidens, blah, something like that.
There needs to be reciprocity.
Sure.
Exactly right.
Which makes sense.
Not really.
Sure it does.
No, it doesn't.
It kind of does. From a pure, if you're going to call witnesses, we're going to call witnesses. It makes sense.
Yeah, but this isn't like, this is the impeachment of a president. It's not like who gets to take turns playing skee ball. The witnesses should be relevant to what the case is about.
And right, they would
say, can I step in here as like the average dumb American who's not really been following impeachment that much?
You can step in,
primary,
but
much
not,
more
as that.
Not on with not that pretext. That. Yeah,
I think this is relevant. Look, as a high information,
you think what is relevant?
The Bolton stuff.
Yeah, look, it's obvious. It was obvious on the day Trump released the transcript that there was a quid pro quo in the White House's own recollection of the call, right?
Yeah, of course.
That's been completely obvious from day one.
Yeah.
Wait, so then how much does this change anything if, as your stand-in for the American voter, it was obvious from day one?
Because this is someone very credible saying directly that there was a quid pro quo. And it's coming after the White House just got done making its case and saying there's no direct, non-anonymous allegation of a quid pro quo.
And what
and
does
now
it
there,
change?
And now there is. It, well, first of all, some other context here is that Trump's numbers on impeachment are actually getting worse. Not dramatically worse, but like it's gone from 48 or 49% went removal to 51%. And non-removal has gone from 47 to 44 or something, right? It's not dramatic, but like it actually hasn't gone that well in the Senate part of the trial for them necessarily. And also, like, if you're a GOP senator, you don't like having the rug pulled out from under you. You don't like having a, I'm sure, obviously there's coordination between the White House and the Congress and Mitch McConnell about kind of how to run this operation. And they probably are smart enough, some of them, to know that there's a little bit of kabuki going on here. And they kind of have to roll their eyes and hold their tongue and not say anything when they know the kabuki's happening, right? This makes the White House look like it's very disorganized and kind of a show that they didn't know this was coming, or they were hoping that it would only come out after the trial was concluded. And so they might say, look, I don't know how this thing's going to unfurl. One thing that always is a risk with any impeachment-related action is that the Senate votes to not to convict, and then further evidence comes out afterward that is very damaging to Trump. And then maybe if you are a swing state senator, you're like, you didn't do your constitutional duty to actually listen to the evidence and call witnesses. Like, I can imagine that being a problem for a swing state Republican.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, Nate brings up a great point, which is the evidence has kind of basically said all this from the beginning. The White House admitted, you know, released a memo, not a transcript, that basically said the same thing. It seems like the evidence is really accumulated to say, like, yeah, this is what happened. And I think what's been so interesting to be locked in for the past couple of months into this just totally bizarre backwards reasoning based entirely on partisanship, and to go back to my point about the gutting of the legislative branch, it's just like this really fascinating, just it's like it's nothing but a moral quandary for these senators, right? Like, that's what it comes down to. I don't think it's an evidence-based thing. It's like but in some ways it's a classic jury trial, right? If a judge is deciding a decision, the lawyers appeal differently, right? They appeal more intellectually, more evidence-based. If you're a trial lawyer, if you're a specialist in that thing, you think about the way you dress, the thing you think about the way you talk to the jury. It's an inherently subjective process. And that's kind of what this is, too. And, like, the jury is actually the American public rather than the senators, because the American public elects the senators and the senators are sort of in the thrall of what they think the public wants to do. I don't know if that's a coherent thought, but I just want to say it's like completely, like, we should acknowledge for a second that we've been locked in a completely like bizarre world for the past 2 months on this impeachment stuff.
Just 2 months?
Well, I'm confining it to this being a heightened period of bizarreness because no one, whatever, this is, it's like, it's no longer interesting to say this, but that's the whole point, is that like everyone's so locked into this thing that the Senate is basically like stepping off a chair and strangling itself. And everyone's kind of like, oh, look, there's something swinging over there. It's like, it's insane.
This is why I say it's such kabuki theater is. First of all, the Bolton stuff is new in the sense that, even though I think the call transcript showed this already, it connects Trump directly to the quid pro quo. A lot of the testimony in the House didn't have firsthand exposure to Trump doing the quid pro quoing, right? So that's new. But it's not like the defense from Republicans or Trump's defense is simply saying, hey, some bad stuff happened here. We think Democrats are overblowing it. It's not impeachable, right? They are like questioning the Congress's ability to conduct oversight of the presidency for abuse of power. It's such an extreme argument that the president's backers have sort of explicitly and implicitly sided with that I think it's, as Claire said, it's like it's stunning to watch and I think belies the emptiness of the whole thing, that it is kabuki theater to a large extent.
So does anyone here think that this new information from John Bolton fundamentally changes that President Trump will be acquitted by the Senate?
I don't know. Wait, hold on. It could.
Oh, sure. It could.
Like, let's not all roll our eyes. Like, maybe.
I've been this entire.
Yeah. No, I do think, like, you know, it could be. We always talk about Susan Collins. I get it. It's becoming this trope. But it's worth saying. This is in her statement about the Bolton stuff. She says, the reports about John Bolton's book strengthened the case for witnesses and have prompted a number of conversations among my colleagues. In our internal Slack channel, someone then posted a tweet from Deb Fischer of Nebraska, and she says, quote, it doesn't take a subpoena to put out a statement. If Ambassador Bolton has something to say, he could do that. So that's the idea of, you don't need to call Bolton to let him have his, you know, have his say. The man can just, like, you know, I don't know, talk to George Stephanopoulos or something.
Which
is true, yeah.
So, okay, there are two levels here, right? Does the Bolton news change what Republican senators are likely to do with regards to allowing witness testimony? I think that's possible. I'm not sure it's likely, but it's possible. And it's certainly likelier than that it will change what they do with regards to acquitting Trump at the end of this, right? But I've been saying all along, despite events continually proving me wrong, that people are like underestimating the chances that this doesn't end in acquittal. Again, I don't think it's likely.
The final piece of this here is, so the likeliest scenario is that President Trump is acquitted. How much then do senators vote on the final resolution of this, acquittal or removal from office, affect their electoral prospects going forward? Like, can we look at the Clinton impeachment and say that some senators had to pay a price for how they voted?
So far, Trump's approval ratings are a little higher than they were pre-impeachment process. Even though impeachment support's also gone up, they've kind of converged a little bit. So although the economy's been pretty good, there are other kind of factors that factor in there. People are in a more partisan mood because of Democratic primary and stuff. But yeah, look, I mean, I don't think we have good answers to this.
Whether or not there are electoral repercussions for how you vote in this.
I mean, for Clinton, like, pretty clearly, Clinton overperformed in the 1998, I guess it was, midterms because people did not like the impeachment trial. That was pretty clear. It's very rare for a party to actually gain seats in a midterm. Democrats did, and impeachment's the explanation. But that was a very, very unpopular impeachment process, whereas this one's like mildly popular. And so it's a bit different. Yeah. I mean, support for calling more witnesses is very high. And so the talking point that, hey, whatever you thought about impeachment, the GOP refused to actually have a fair trial and call witnesses, like, that's a pretty decent talking point, I think, for Democrats, right?
So if this is fated to end in acquittal anyway, do Democrats actually not want witnesses?
Maybe, right?
Oh, because then it just gives them a good talking
it's a
point
better,
of
it's
Republicans
a blocked.
I think I continue to think that enough of them would, under the right circumstances, be willing to throw Biden under the bus.
Reciprocity?
Yeah.
Anything's possible in this topsy-turvy world we live in. Okay,
by the way.
What were you going to say, Clay?
Nothing. I'm going to refrain.
Don't refrain.
No.
Frain.
No, it was going to be... No.
Unfrain.
Frain.
Just
away.
I was going to say frame. we should officially put Kabuki Theater on our do not say or
no,
write
Kabuki
list of trite things.
Kabuki dance.
Kabuki.
If you watch any of the networks while the impeachment coverage is going on, they say Kabuki like every
time. I know. It
minutes.
Goes it add it to my list of pet peeves of use of state nicknames. And Kabuki Theater.
Well, the Hawkeye State. The Hawkeye State.
No, okay. I am going to have a stroke
on
caucus night.
If you have to write Iowa 47 times.
No.
So you just say Iowa, Iowa,
yes.
Iowa.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
You can also just say the
strongly
state.
Strongly held opinion.
You could just say the state.
If residents of the Hawkeye state could write
it
in.
I don't care.
Let us know what
I literally
saying.
Don't care. It is so folksy and stupid, and I hate it for every
single name. Let's do a test. Iowa, Hawkeye state. New Hampshire, Micah.
Granite state.
I knew that one. Granite state.
South Carolina.
Palmetto state.
Nevada.
Prostitution.
Silver state.
Woo!
I know all of them.
We're leaving in
I know all of them because I did that 50-state series.
Can you guys all say the states in order? People acted
Alabama,
like
West
Arizona, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Hawaii, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, Virginia, Washington, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Wyoming. Boom, Amy Klobuchar, it's not that hard.
Very nice.
Can you name the 7 non-state nominating contests in the Democratic primary?
Guam, Puerto Rico,
U.S. Virgin Islands.
Democrats abroad.
Oh, I forgot that's one.
Yeah, they vote on Super Tuesday.
They start voting on Super Tuesday, but it's like a 10-day process. Okay.
Micronesia?
Actually. No, not Micronesia. They get screwed.
Wait, how many do we have so far?
Four.
Yeah.
What are the last three? Them.
Give us a hint. Wait, did someone say the Virgin
Islands? You're missing two really obvious ones and one
Washington, D.C.
American right. Samoa.
American Samoa.
American Samoa.
And Washington, D.C.
And then this one's a hard one?
And this is an easy one. This is probably the first one you should have gotten.
What? Non-state voters on the primary.
You're erasing.
Military?
You're erasing this place that's had a lot of bad stuff happen to it recently.
Guantanamo?
We already said Puerto Rico.
You didn't say Puerto Rico.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, we did.
Yes, we did.
All right, you got all of them.
I was like, are there Democratic voters in Guantanamo?
Guantanamo caucus. Can you imagine?
The Guantanamo Bay caucus.
Wait, who would they vote for?
Okay, you did miss one. You did miss one, which is a hard one. The Northern Marianas Islands.
Oh, okay. Clearly, we're having a lot of fun because it's our birthday, but we're going to leave things there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Micah.
Send us birthday presents.
Okay, come on.
A couple things before we go. One, we have a live show in Manchester, New Hampshire on Sunday, February 9th, 2 days before the primary there. Go get your tickets at 538.com/live. Also this week, 538 is launching the When Women Run Project. And here's a little explainer about what this is. 100 years after women were granted the right to vote, the U.S. has more women in political office than ever before. Yet gender has haunted the 2020 campaign, including questions about whether a woman can win the presidency. So to better understand what it's like to run for political office as a woman, we spoke to 97 women who have done it. We're going to be displaying their stories, their words on our website and in this podcast feed. I know, Claire, you spoke to Stacey Abrams as part of this project.
Yeah. There'll be a standalone podcast interview and some video of that coming up later this week.
And then also on Tuesday, we have a compilation of many of the different interviews that staffers from across the 538 newsroom did. So check out this feed on Tuesday. And then again, towards the end of the week, I believe Friday is when we're going to have the Stacey Abrams interview. And again, that's the When Women Run Project. So check it out, 538.com and this podcast feed.
I'm very excited about
this
project.
Yeah, it's a real site-wide effort since the summer.
Site-wide, the Abrams interview in particular, but also just like so much of the conversation around gender and sexism in elections is like abstract and wishy-washy, and it's like just it's hard to measure. And so talking to all these women who ran, you get a tangible sense of how it affects these elections in a way I think that's hard in most day-to-day coverage.
Yeah, looking forward to it. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.